The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It's Friday, everyone. Yeah. We made it to the end, almost, of another week, and that's a good thing. We've got a busy, big show for you today. Both Ari Berman and Harvey J.K. will be here, so let's get to it. You know, I like to start the show with a funny every day, and I was thinking, you know, it's time for a new Randy Rainbow production. I start getting antsy about the three-week mark, but he's a busy guy. He's on tour, and he does everything on those videos himself, so I'll cut him some slack. Today is Donald Trump's 73rd birthday, and the internet is celebrating it by proclaiming today John McCain Day. By the way, it is the top trending item on Twitter right now, hashtag John McCain Day. Just saying. In honor of the dump's birthday, I thought we'd pull out an old, well, a classic Randy Rainbow song from the vault to help celebrate. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you. Take it away, Randy Rainbow.
We are back, and I'm joined now by a very special guest, the President of the United States. Are we still going with that title? Yes? They're telling me yes? Okay, still good. Welcome, Mr. President. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you must be very busy cleaning out your desk. It has been quite a dramatic news week for you.
They make up lies. I've seen it many times. They make up things.
I mean, two former employees convicted, one implicating you as a co-conspirator in his crimes, a public feud with your attorney general, friends and allies, even doormen flipping on you left and right.
I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching Flippers.
Such a good show.
Look, I didn't know Manafort well. He wasn't with the campaign long.
Well, then why don't we start with your former attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen?
I always found him to be a nice guy.
Were you aware of the hush money payments he is now saying were financed by the campaign per your instruction?
They didn't come out of the campaign. They came from me, and I tweeted about it. You know, I don't know if you know, but I tweeted about the payments. But they didn't come out of campaign.
Did they come out of the campaign?
They didn't come out of the campaign, and that's big.
Huge.
Because that could be
illegal.
A little dicey.
Or illegal.
But they weren't. It's not even a campaign violation. If you look at President Obama, he had a massive
pecker. David Pecker, your friend and CEO of the National Enquirer, has recently been granted immunity in the Cohen investigation and is said to have a lot of dirt on you.
I don't know. I've always had controversy in my life, and I've always succeeded. I've always won.
Well, some say you're about to win, most likely to get impeached.
I'll tell you what. If I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash.
If you ever got impeached?
I think everybody would be very poor.
Why? If you ever got impeached, you would...
You would probably start crying, then rehash all the lying and rhetoric you've preached. All the Dems would be smirking. Jim Acosta would start twerking if you ever got impeached.
If I ever got impeached.
You could just give in to Mueller, then go and get some color by lying on a beach. This is all natural, right? With the crimes you've been fixing, you could be another Nixon if you only got impeached.
I think the market would crash.
You'd be through and take with you our worries and our strife. You'd return to only burdening your wife, and we'd resume a normal life.
Oh yeah.
Find a lawyer, cause you'll need one. Write a book or learn to read one. Or get your eyebrows bleached. Just relax at the spa, go fuck yourself at Mar-a-Lago if you get impeached.
I don't know how you can impeach somebody who's done a great job.
You'd be more than implicated for laws you violated and protocols you breached.
Because without this thinking,
we could finally all stop drinking if you ever got impeached.
I think everybody would be very poor.
We would dance and sing and revel. No one else has hit the level of infamy you've reached. Giuliani could retire. Pence could join a gay men's choir if you ever get impeached.
The president did nothing wrong.
When you flee, take Huckabee. And finally I'll be calm. I'd ask Michael Avenatti to the prom.
Oh, wow.
And Kellyanne could move to Guam. More than half the country's waiting, so think about the ratings. Cause when you gave your speech, we would all tune in to listen. You could finally go to prison.
I'm not involved. I wasn't charged with anything.
If you ever got impeached,
I think everybody would be very poor.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Ah! Oh, my.
Back,
oh, hold on.
Joined-
Wait. We were just about to go for more of Randy Rainbow. What a great way to start a Friday. Randy Rainbow, that from his archives. The good news is it's been about a month since his last video, so there's a new one coming anytime now. Yes. Okay, so much news to get to today. I guess we should start. The biggest news of the day is that the Democratic Party, the DNC, has announced the debate lineups. The first debate will be split into two nights because we know there are 20 who qualified. Actually, there were 24 candidates. The corporate media, for some reason, is ignoring Mike Gravel. Mike Gravel did not qualify for these first debates, but I just got an email from his campaign that said he's on track to be in the July debate. So if you can, donate a dollar or two to Mike Gravel because he should be on that stage. Everyone else met the threshold with the exception of Montana Governor Steve Bullock. And from reports I read, it seems that he missed out by one respondent in a poll, not 1%, as I originally thought, but one respondent. Oy. Okay. Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, who? Yeah. And Miramar, Florida Mayor Wayne Messam. Miramar, Florida is a couple of towns over. By the way, bigger town than South Bend, Indiana, in case you were wondering, but nobody gives a shit about Wayne Messam. So that's it. The Knights, they did a random drawing out of the top tier and the second tier candidates in order to get a good representation both nights, which seems to have kind of backfired on them. Because night one, June 26th, which is a Wednesday night, June 26th, on the debate stage will be Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, John Delaney, Tulsi Gabbard, Julian Castro, Tim Ryan. I'm doing the first names by memory, so if I stumble, that's why. Bill de Blasio, Jay Inslee, and Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren has the stage basically to herself. She is the only top-tier candidate on that first night, so good for her. She drew the lucky straw. In the second night, that's when you have Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Bennett, what's his name? Bennett, whoever. Marianne Williamson, Eric Swalwell, Kirsten Gillibrand, Andrew Yang, and John Frackenlooper. Should be interesting. All right. Right. Ryan for Prez in the YouTube chat room. Gravel shouldn't have to grovel to get into the debates. Anyway, so that's it. Most of the heavy hitters are on night two. I'm glad Bernie gets to go up against Joe Biden because Bernie will be more, how do we say, blunt than anybody else, I think. But I think Kamala Harris and probably Kirsten Gillibrand will go after Biden as well. We'll see. It'll be interesting. Yes. So that's the lineup. I do have more news for you, but that's the biggest breaking news story for the day, other than, you know, John McCain Day trending on Twitter as a burn to dump, who's 73 today. All right. I told you we have a busy show, so we're going to get right into it. Harvey J.K., our friend, professor from University of Wisconsin at Green Bay, who's a professor of justice and democracy, I think is, I mean, what a great job that is. He will join us again at the bottom of the hour to talk about democratic socialism and Bernie's big speech the other night, because it, frankly, did not get the attention it deserved from the media. So we will focus in on it. But before we get to that, we're joined by Ari Berman of Mother Jones Magazine. We've been talking about the attempts by this administration to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. Ari Berman, well, you know what? Let's just, I taped with him earlier. So rather than be redundant, let's go to the tape, everyone, shall we? Ari Berman is senior reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, covering voting rights, and the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He's also one of the best voices out there covering voting rights and the Republicans' efforts to suppress them. That includes the disturbing story that surfaced, I want to say about a year ago, about a new citizenship question this administration wants to add to the 2020 census. Now, the Supreme Court has already heard the case and is expected to hand down a decision by the end of the month when the court session ends. But there was a development in the case just, I think, a couple of weeks ago after the Supreme Court hearing that Ari Berman reported on for Mother Jones in a piece titled, Architect of GOP Gerrymandering Was Behind Trump's Census Citizenship Question. Before we get to the newer news, Ari, first of all, thank you so much for joining us again. And
hey, good to talk to you.
Can you fill us in on this Tom Heffler story, what we learned about this architect of gerrymandering and what his role was here?
Yes, what we learned a few weeks ago was that a guy by the name of Tom Heffler, who has basically been the leading gerrymanderer for the GOP since the 1980s. He is the guy that goes all around the country helping Republicans draw maps to try to boost their representation, and has drawn some of the most sophisticated gerrymanders of the past few decades. It turned out that he was one of the key people behind this census citizenship question, and in a few different ways. First off, he published this study finding that if you use the citizenship question to then draw districts counting only citizens, because currently the way districts are drawn is that everyone is counted, but if you just restricted only citizens to counting, that would lead to something that he said would be advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites, and clearly detrimental to the Democratic Party. So, I mean, that was very alarming, because it said that we all knew that the purpose of this question was to benefit Republicans and whites. And then it turned out that what the Justice Department did was that they wrote a letter to the Commerce Department formally requesting the census citizenship question. And that's what Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross used to justify this decision. And the argument made by the Justice Department was that this was needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Now, that was a ludicrous argument, because everyone knows the Trump administration has no interest in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. But it turns out that Tom Heffler, the gerrymandering guy, was the one who told the Trump administration, say that this is needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act, when Heffler had already concluded it would hurt Latinos and other minority groups that the Voting Rights Act was supposed to protect. And so, I mean, we had kind of two smoking gun pieces of evidence. First off, that he was explicitly saying we need to do this to help Republicans politically. And secondly, that he helped invent this fig leaf argument the Trump administration is using to sell this.
Wow. And we learned this. It was his estranged daughter after he died who went through his computer and found notes. How did this come to life?
It's a wild story. So Heffler drew all the maps in North Carolina after the 2010 election, both the congressional maps and the state legislative maps. Both of those maps have been struck down in court. But there is still a new trial in state court in North Carolina over the state legislative map, trying to get rid of all the state legislative districts before the 2020 election. And so Heffler is the guy that drew the maps. And so what happened was his daughter, who he's estranged from, after Hoffler died last year, went to his house and found all these hard drives. And she was initially just looking for pictures of her family.
Uh-huh.
But she found all 75,000 files on these hard drives. She handed them over to Common Cause North Carolina, who is challenging these legislative maps. And they found this unrelated information about the census, which they then made public. And that's how we know all of this.
Wow. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, when this new information came to light, the Supreme Court had already heard the case about the citizenship question being added to the census. Do we have any indications whether or not this new information will have any effect on the Supreme Court's ruling?
We don't. I mean, at the oral arguments, the Supreme Court justices, the five conservatives, seemed fairly sympathetic to the Trump administration's argument. Mm. So there was already a lot of evidence in the case that the Trump administration was lying, that this was needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act. But the judges themselves didn't really ask any questions about that. And it's kind of funny because you have, like, Chief Justice John Roberts saying, well, don't we need this to enforce the Voting Rights Act? When, remember, Roberts is the guy who wrote the majority opinion gutting the Voting Rights
Act
in 2013. So, I mean, suddenly you have the Trump administration and the conservative Supreme Court caring about enforcing the Voting Rights Act when the Supreme Court won't enforce the Voting Rights Act and the Trump administration won't enforce the Voting Rights Act. I mean, so if they were already sympathetic to the Trump administration, it's not clear that they're going to change their opinion. However, the ACLU has filed a number of briefs, both in lower court and now just before the Supreme Court, saying at the very least, remand this to lower courts, let them look at this new evidence.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know. I could see that potentially being an escape route. I could see them potentially punting. But I think that the Supreme Court's going to do what they want to do regardless of the facts in this case.
Wow. So they're not obligated to consider this new evidence that came to light after they had already heard the case.
They're not obligated to consider it because it's not in the official record in the case, meaning that a lower court has not ruled on this evidence. And there's processes usually that things go through to get before the court. Now, the justices look at extra legal evidence all the time. So they certainly could look at it, and they certainly could cite the new evidence, or they could cite the briefs that have just been filed and say, listen, we're just unsure about this. We're not ready to make up our mind. The problem here is that the Census Bureau is under a timeline to print the 2020 forms because this is a giant operation, and this is a $15 billion operation.
Right.
And so we're running out of time to decide this one way or the other. I mean, the ACLU just said, well, maybe it could wait till October, but it can't wait forever. And so one way or another, we're going to need to know what's on the census form relatively soon.
Oh, boy. Ari Berman is with us. Of course, he's a senior reporter at Mother Jones Magazine who does just amazing work covering voting rights and the Republican efforts to suppress those rights. On Wednesday, it seemed like a lot of action happened around this case, beginning with Donald Trump invoking executive privilege to block Congress's access to documents about how this question came to be added to the census. Was that expected?
It wasn't not expected.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. I mean, the Trump administration's desperately been trying to hide the key evidence in this case because every time a new piece of evidence comes out, it contradicts both their timeline and their claims. And so, remember, initially, Wilbur Ross said that this was needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Everyone knows that's not true.
Right.
There's tons and tons of memos showing the opposite. Then he claimed that the Justice Department requested it, when in fact Ross was basically telling the Justice Department, you need to request this. So, in fact, the fix was in from the beginning. Then Wilbur Ross said, I didn't consult with anyone from the White House when he was talking to Steve Bannon and all these other anti-immigrant people about it. And Steve Bannon put Ross in touch with Chris Kobach, the architect of voter suppression in Kansas. I mean, so just everything we know about this case contradicts what Trump administration officials have said under oath and also just in general about this. So they don't want anything new to come out. And so they've been stonewalling the congressional investigation. And finally, Congress had enough, and the House Oversight Committee voted to hold Roth and Attorney General Barr in contempt of Congress for failing to hand over these key documents. And then the administration invoked executive privilege, which is really crazy because executive privilege, as I understand it, is really supposed to be about conversations between the president that need to be confidential.
Mm-hmm.
This has nothing to do, this supposedly has nothing to do with the president, remember, right? This was supposedly made by the Justice Department in coordination with the Commerce Department. So why are they evoking executive privilege over something that they claim the executive had no role over? So, I mean, it just further deepens the fact that this seems just like a giant cover-up. And they're hoping the Supreme Court's going to bail them out. But I think any thorough investigation would just reveal that the Trump administration's been completely full of it from the beginning to the end of this process.
Right, of course. Meanwhile, here we are. We're sitting in the middle of June. The Supreme Court's term ends at the end of the month. The end of June is typically when they hand down their major decisions. Obviously, gerrymandering is going to be a big one. And a separate question is what to do about the citizenship question. Are those the only two voting-related cases we're waiting on a resolution from the Supreme Court on?
Yeah, we're waiting on that. We're also waiting on a case about racial gerrymandering in Virginia, what to do about 11 state legislative districts, which is important there because they have elections in Virginia this year.
Mm-hmm.
And despite all the craziness going on in that state, Democrats could actually take back the Virginia legislature in 2019, which would then matter because they're going to draw districts in 2021. So it's the 2019 election in Virginia that will determine the next round of redistricting, just like the 2020 election in other states is going to determine redistricting. And of course, redistricting is based on the census, which is why the citizenship question is so important. Because if they can get this citizenship question on the census, what it will mean is there will be fewer responses from Latinos and other immigrant groups, which will mean that both economic and political power will be shifted to whiter areas. Then if they can use that information to then draw districts only based on citizenship, they can further shift power to wider Republican areas. And then if the Supreme Court says you can also keep doing this gerrymandering, well, then the gerrymandering efforts are only going to get worse because they have this powerful new tool in terms of how they've rigged the census. So that's why this is all related. And I mean, it's just if they were to both uphold partisan gerrymandering and uphold the citizenship question on the census at the same time, that would just be an incredible power grab by the Republicans. I mean, Democrats have done their fair of gerrymandering too, but overwhelmingly this has benefited the Republican Party since the 2010 election. And if they get both a rigged census and a green light to gerrymander, it's going to be really scary to see what they can do in 2021 and beyond.
No kidding. You know, this is so, we always talk about how important it is, you know, state and local elections are every bit as important, if not more in this respect, than the national elections, the federal elections. Now, in 2020, so they'll do the census, and then it's based on those numbers. Each state government sets up their own district lines. That's where gerrymandering comes into play. So it's really it's based on the results of the census. But in each state, it depends on who controls the legislature because they're the ones who get to use the new data from the census to draw the new maps.
Exactly. I mean, there are a few states that have independent redistricting commissions, for example, where legislators don't draw the lines. But in the majority of the states, that's what happens. It's a partisan process. And I think one of the things that I'm really concerned about in 2020 is that state elections aren't getting enough coverage, that we're so focused on the presidential campaign that we're losing sight that all of these states are going to be the ones that draw districts for the next decade. And, you know, we're going to have the next president for 4 years, but we're going to have maps in many states that are going to last for an entire decade. And so I would hope that this becomes something of an urgent priority for Democrats. Maybe the Supreme Court cases will focus their attention on the need to sort of invest some resources into this. I haven't heard anything about the for example, the Virginia elections in 2019. And so I don't know. It just seems like one of those things that there's 23 Democrats running for president. I think that's the latest tally. I don't even remember. 23 or 24 at this point. And that's super important. But you know what? It's very hard for the everyday person to affect the presidential election. It's a whole lot easier to affect the state legislative election, where sometimes you're talking about 10,000, 20,000 votes deciding who could be the key vote drawing the maps. I mean, we saw in 2017 in Virginia's election, it literally came down to drawing straws out
That's
of a
right.
hat.
That's right. I
who
remember.
Who controlled the Virginia legislature.
Yeah,
and
I mean, Republicans
so I would
won
just
again.
Hope that, exactly. I would just hope that, you know, Democrats and progressives don't forget about the importance of state elections, because ultimately the census and gerrymandering, a lot of this stuff is going to happen at the state level, not the federal level.
Right. And the Democrats have and always have had, at least in recent history, a messaging problem. This should have been the message they've hammered over the past 10 years. You mentioned the 2010 census. We're dealing with those maps and the Republican control of so many state legislatures. 2010, people should remember, was the wave that brought in the Tea Party, this huge, massive takeover. Over a lot of government by Republicans in that 2010 wave. Well, now we're coming up on 2020 when the Democrats, by all rights, thank you Trump, should have a big wave, but they don't seem to have been focusing on taking back those state legislatures.
I think in 2018 they did focus on them because Trump wasn't on the ballot,
right.
And I think that was a big shift. They spent a lot more attention in 2018 focusing on state races than they did in 2010, and they made a lot of progress. They picked up 300 state legislative seats, which was fewer than Republicans picked up in 2010, but you have to start somewhere, right? And
right.
It was by far their best election of the last decade on the state level. And so, I mean, if they can pick up another 300 seats in 2020, they'll be in pretty good shape going into 2021. I mean, they'll at least have divided government in a bunch of places. And they're not that far off. I mean, even in places like Florida, which seem pretty red, I think there are only like six states or less from taking back one of those chambers. And all you need to do is take back one of the chambers in a state legislative chamber to at least have a divided process.
Yeah, and I'll tell you.
So, I mean,
Florida is so weird because, you know, I live in Florida. We have more registered Democrats than Republicans, but I guess it's gerrymandering. The Republicans control every except for agriculture secretary that the Democrats won in 2018. The Republicans control all of state government.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend a whole different episode talking about the strange politics of
yes,
your home state.
Yes,
but basically, I mean, the point is that Democrats aren't that far away in a lot of these states. That even despite the gerrymandering in a lot of places, they've made major inroads in a lot of key swing states. And so I think that's just going to be really important that they don't lose sight of all of these local elections. And I think that's one of the things the presidential candidates can do is as they're campaigning in all of these states, they can focus attention on down ballot races.
Mm-hmm.
They can campaign with candidates in down ballot races. They can talk about the importance of them. When whoever's the nominee can make sure people vote in down ballot races. Another problem is that often people don't even vote down the ballot. And so hopefully this primary process will help get a lot of Democrats motivated beyond the presidential election, because I think you're going to see probably record turnout in the primaries and all of these key swing states because of all the people running and the desire to defeat Trump. And that effort can be translated into down ballot elections. It could also just as easily overlook them. And so we're kind of at this inflection point with that now.
Yeah, people need to realize just how much is at stake. All right, Ari Berman, one last question for you. Back to the Supreme Court. Again, they're going to rule before the end of the month on not only the citizenship census question, but the partisan gerrymandering case that was heard earlier in the year. Let's pull a little bit of optimism out of the air. If they find in favor of the groups challenging the partisan gerrymandering, would this affect the maps for the 2020 presidential elections? Would that kick in time?
Yes. I mean, that's the big thing, is that not only in the cases in North Carolina and elsewhere, so there were two cases in North Carolina and Maryland that are before the court. Both of those places, they can redraw the maps before 2020. Then there are other cases making their way to the court. Two cases in Ohio and Michigan where they also said you need to redraw the maps. So we could see in four states, including three really important swing states controlled by Republicans, the maps redrawn before 2020. And then, of course, it would just make it a lot easier to challenge these things in the future. And it would send a signal to Republicans not to do this kind of thing in 2021. So I think it would be tremendously important. I don't think they're going to do that, but I think it would be tremendously important if they were to do that.
Most definitely. Ari Berman, I can't think of anyone I'd rather talk to about these issues than you. So thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us and explaining it all, as you do so well. People can find you, of course, at Mother Jones Magazine, on Twitter at Ari Berman. And of course, it came out, I want to say, close to 5 years ago already. But the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, is still very relevant today. Okay. And it should be on the top of anyone's reading list who's concerned about our election system. Ari Berman, thank you again. It's always great to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Nicole. Great to talk to you.
You take care. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, there you go. Ari Berman, just in case you were wondering, yes, we taped that yesterday, so it's still a brand new interview, never been heard before, but just taped yesterday. Ari Berman, one of the most hardworking guys who knows this issue inside and out. Okay. We didn't get to what's news. Maybe we'll just play that at the end of the show because there's a lot of news there. But I do want to get to our friend Harvey J.K. So I'll tell you what. Well, we have a new sponsor on the show. Kind of, sort of. It's a joke. Anyway, so stick around. It's Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. Back in just a moment with Harvey J.K. First, this word from a new sponsor.
The adventure back in your vacation with a carnivore cruise. Get a great tan, visit Iran, we've got the guns. Swimsuits packed, you'll see Iraq, we've got the guns. The weather's great here in the Strait of Hormuz. No tour of duty like a Persian Gulf cruise. Most vacations are just killing time, but at carnivore cruises, we're just killing. You'll visit exciting ports of call like Kuwait, Bahrain, even Saudi Arabia. Gourmet dining, enemy mining, we've got the guns. 2, 4, and 7 month vacations available now. Just call your naval recruiter or Carnivore Cruise Lines, cause Carnivore's got the guns.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
Well, where is he?
Where is who?
Where is Harvey?
Oh, you mean Harvey J.K.
Yeah, Harvey.
Well, he's coming up right now on The Nicole Sandler Show.
Yeah, he is. Hold on. I got to get all my ducks in a row here. By the way, that Carnivore Cruise Lines commercial, that was our pal Boca Brittany Summers. She will be here with us next Friday. Lot to talk about. So put that in your calendar. Boca Britt here next Friday. Okay. Now, Harvey J.K. Hey there, Harvey.
Hello. I still get a kick out of the
intro,
the introductory tape.
Yes, yes, and that also is our pal Boca Britt Summers, who just does brilliant work. So it's been a while since Brittany's been here, so she'll be here on again on next Friday. So Harvey J.K., in addition to being the professor of democracy and justice, what is the actual title?
It's the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies.
I love that. What a great job. That's what you do. That's who you are at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. You're also the author of a number of books, including The Fight for the Four Freedoms and Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. But today we're going to really focus in on The Fight for the Four Freedoms, because this was FDR. And FDR, right. I believe, and you're the professor here. I was just a bad student. I skated through school without much studying, and you know, got B's and C's, but I was not quite the student. But FDR, at least in my book, he was, if not the best, certainly one of our best American presidents. As I said yesterday, I don't think this nation would have survived the Depression had it not been for FDR and the New Deal. And sadly, we are so separated today, so divided today, that those kind of policies would be hard to get through. Thank goodness we have a candidate like Bernie Sanders who's trying his damnedest to do that and to bring back FDR's ideas and build on what he started all those years ago. Is that the main message you got from Bernie Sanders, Harvey?
Well, yeah. I mean, as you know,
hold on one second. Harvey, I know you changed microphones. Can you turn down your gain a little bit? Because you're really hot. I mean, you're hot, but not
that
way.
Does that help at all?
Yeah, that's much better. Yep. Even bring it down a little more.
A little more. I'm wondering if...
That's perfect. Right
that's
there.
That's perfect?
Of course.
Okay, I'm having a hard time hearing you, I'll just keep it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
It's really strange. I don't get why that's happening. Okay. Well, what's really interesting to me, what really struck me this week is as his speech approached, I kept sending as many tweets as I could to lots of people, including Bernie's own campaign, saying, please, when you're going to do this democratic socialism talk, do your damnedest to go back and lay claim to FDR. Now, by that time, probably Bernie had already decided that. But as you know, for all the years we've been talking, I have been frustrated as can be that Bernie, who is so well positioned to really lay claim to America's past, and especially to the New Deal, the Four Freedoms, the Second Bill of Rights, that he did it once, and he did it well that one time back in the fall of 2015, but he basically dropped the ball in the course of the later primaries against Hillary. And I didn't hear anything from him these last few years that would sort of be promising to his doing what I kept hoping he would do. But the other day, on Wednesday, I think that was one. I think that speech, in its own way, especially if Bernie should be elected, was historic. I mean, he reached back to the 1930s and the 1940s. He really recalled FDR's finest arguments, both of 1936 and of 1944-36, having to do with the degree to which the powers that be were doing their damnedest to undermine the New Deal and to keep working people from realizing their desires, their aspirations. And then he went ahead to 1944, as we'll review, and laid claim once again to FDR's call for an economic bill of rights. And then he goes on, as we'll see, to actually remind everyone of the promise and not just repeat what Roosevelt did and not just recall the troubles of those days past, but he actually then restates it in a 21st century fashion. He calls for a 21st century economic bill of rights.
That's right.
And I can tell you, I was just frankly blown away by it.
As was I. And I recommend, even if you heard it when it happened live yesterday, was it yesterday or was it Wednesday?
Wednesday.
I would recommend listening to it again and reading along with the transcript of what he said, because there's so much there. Finally, he's drawing on history and making the connection. You know, so many people freak out about the S word, the socialism. And, you know, I almost wish it was a different word entirely. Democratic socialism is not socialism. It's a different thing. And he's done his best to explain what the difference is. And the great explanation was right there in the correlation with FDR. This is a continuation.
Yeah, in some ways, as long as you brought up the question of the name or the word.
Yep.
What is interesting is that if we take Bernie and we put him alongside, say, Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
And Warren is a progressive.
I believe
so. Bernie
Sanders
is a democratic socialist.
Right.
But really, what Warren is talking about over and over again is social democracy.
Yes.
And what Bernie, even though he calls himself a democratic socialist, is talking about is social democracy. And you can see significant differences between them, but not so significant that they couldn't both carry this name of social democracy, which I think is just the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Right. So Bernie did this speech. I know I asked you when we confirmed that we were going to talk about it today. I said, if there are any clips in the speech you want me to pull, just send me notes and I'll pull them. And you dug in. So I've got a lot of audio.
I
got to tell you, because cutting up this speech, I'm constantly, I'm my own producer, I'm my engineer, I'm my own everything. So I'm always pulling audio. And I cut up speeches like that all the time. It was really difficult to chop that one up into, you know, tidy little sound bites, because it seemed like almost every line was really important. He said something substantive throughout that entire speech that lasted almost an hour.
Yeah, definitely did. I don't know if we're going to be going specifically to them, but I can tell you that what was really interesting at the outset. Well, do you have a good clip from the outset? Maybe we can launch into that.
Okay. Well, how about this one? You mentioned FDR. Here's one clip in which Bernie referenced FDR. Well, hear for yourself.
We rejected the ideology of Mussolini and Hitler, and we instead embrace the bold and visionary leadership of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then the leader of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Together with organized labor, leaders in the African American community, and progressives inside and outside the Democratic Party, Roosevelt led a transformation of the American government and the American economy. Like today, the quest for transformative change was opposed by big business, by Wall Street, by the political establishment, by the Republican Party, and by the conservative wing of FDR's own Democratic Party. And he faced the same scare tactics then that we experience today. Red baiting, xenophobia, racism, and anti-Semitism.
So that's just one clip. And yes,
yeah,
that
was great. Yeah, if I can just say what he does there is, and there's so much even within those few written paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
So he's reaching back to 1936 specifically, because this is when FDR is running for a second term as president, and he knows that the major corporate interests, we'll call them the billionaires of the day, that they have mobilized against him. They created something called the American Liberty League, and they spent millions on radio, on what used to call film strips, on these various means, pamphlets, etc., to try to point a finger at FDR as if he was either a Stalinist communist or even worse, a fascist. Equally evil. And what he does is he calls out. Bernie himself calls out the opposition, just as FDR did in 1936 when he accepted the nomination for the presidency. I mean, you think about it. FDR knew what he was up against. He was up against big business. He was up against the right wing of the day. And he knew that he had to live with, but he knew the opposition that he faced in many ways from the Southern Democrats, who would later become Dixiecrats and, of course, later become Republicans. So here's Bernie saying, okay, we know what we're up against, but let me actually call them out. How many Democrats have you ever heard call out the opposition of big business, of the Republicans, and of the conservatives, or better yet, maybe they're called moderates, but call them the conservatives of the Democratic Party.
Right.
I mean, even among the candidates running right now, there are those who call themselves moderates, but they might as well be Republicans of the Eisenhower variety.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the only one who consistently calls them out by name is Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren, to an extent, but she stops herself. She's a little too...
Yeah, she's
cordial.
Hedging. She is.
Yeah, she's a little too cordial, I think. That's her thing. It's interesting that in the debates, Warren is going to be on the first night and Bernie will be on the second night. And I kind of like it that way. Let there be a good progressive on each night.
Which one got Biden? Was it Bernie got Biden?
Bernie got Biden. Elizabeth Warren is with all, second tier candidates. She basically has a stage to herself, which she won the draw here. The way they picked it, by the way, because I saw people in the chat rooms asking, they separated the top tier candidates with the lower, the others.
Uh-huh.
And they did a drawing, like one from column A, one from column B to supposedly to make it more evenly split. I don't know how that worked because it doesn't seem to have with four of the top tier candidates on one night and one on the other. It just doesn't seem to have worked. As to which night came first, after the two, after the 10 were separated into two groups, then I guess NBC network executives tried to decide strategically which would be better for viewership. And so they put the Elizabeth Warren one on the first night and all the heavy hitters except for her on the second night.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's even now, I think I'm going to have to talk myself into watching either one of those groups.
Again, I just hope Joe Biden gets enough time to speak to adequately insert his foot fully in his mouth. I want him to get a lot of time, because the more he speaks, the more people will go, oh, shit, that's Joe Biden. He's not Obama. He's Biden. We rejected him how many times already? So anyway, that's that.
Well, in that vein, though, I'll just tell you, years ago, when he first ran for president, the very first time, the year would be, was that 92?
No, I think it was 88.
88? Okay. Well, that very first time, that was when he was caught out for having plagiarized a speech of Neil Kinnock,
right,
who was the British Labour Party leader. And the redeeming value of that is that at least he was quoting a democratic socialist Biden, okay?
Yeah.
That was the redeeming value. Of course, the other fact is that it turned out he wasn't only plagiarizing from Kinnock, he was plagiarizing from other folks as well.
God.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, yeah. Well, as people say, if worse has to come to worse, you bet I'll vote for Biden against Trump,
of course.
As I voted for Hillary
against
Trump.
But this is the primary season when we get to advocate for the best candidate possible. This is when we strive for perfection. I get in the general, we can't strive for perfection. Oftentimes, it comes down to it has in my whole lifetime the lesser of two evils, and it really sucks. In primary season, this is why I love primaries, because you can go for your favorite, you can love and cheer them on and advocate for them and explain what makes them so great and really push for the best we can do, which is what we should be doing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, if we could go back to FDR and Bernie for a little bit, there were a whole series of things that struck me about that speech. I'll just remind everyone in case, or maybe they don't actually realize that Franklin Roosevelt, when he ran originally in 1932 and won the presidency, even then he had called for what he termed an economic declaration of rights, basically.
Yep.
He said that the corporate titans of industry had basically concentrated wealth and power, and the time was for us to revisit the promise of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness,
right,
and in many ways to create a new declaration, and he called it an economic declaration of rights. And a lot of people don't realize that when he later, in 1941, projects the promise or vision of the four freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear, he's really just continuing this sort of what's already been 8 year period in which he has really tried in the New Deal to make the Economic Declaration of Rights mean something in Americans' lives.
Right. So, and, you know what? Let's listen to these clips. This first one is a little lengthy. What I did, if you notice, it sounds like it's moving a little faster than it did during the speech. I didn't speed Bernie up at all, but I did cut the applause down. And I cut some of the pregnant pauses, so it moves faster. So just know he got a hell of a lot more applause than you're hearing in these clips. I just shortened them for time. And there were pregnant pauses between, you know, as he spoke, but I sped it up so we could hear more. So this is Bernie, again, recalling the vision of FDR in 1944 for a second Bill of Rights. Right?
Yes, the second Bill of Rights or Economic Bill of Rights.
Well, but there's two. There's this FDR's second Bill of Rights, and then there's the Bernie's call for a 21st century economic Bill of Rights.
Absolutely, right.
So this is the first one.
Yes.
Well, this is the first one.
Over 80 years ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt helped create a government that made transformative progress in protecting the needs of working families. Today, in the second decade of the 21st century, we must take up the unfinished business of the New Deal and carry it to completion. This is the unfinished business of the Democratic Party and the vision we together must accomplish. In order to accomplish that goal, it means committing ourselves to protecting political rights, to protecting civil rights, and to protect economic rights for all of the people in our country. As FDR stated in his 1944 State of the Union address, and I quote, "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence," end quote. Today, our Bill of Rights guarantees the American people a number of important constitutionally protected political rights. And while we understand that these rights have not always been respected, and we have so much work to do in order to protect those rights. We are proud that our Constitution guarantees freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, a free press, and other rights, because we understand that we can never have true American freedom unless we are free from authoritarian tyranny. But now we must take the next step forward and guarantee every man, woman, and child in our country basic economic rights, the right to quality health care, the right to as much education as one needs to succeed in our society, the right to a good job that pays a living wage, the right to affordable housing, the right to a secure retirement, and the right to live in a clean environment. We must recognize that in the 21st century, in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, economic rights are human rights. And that is what I mean by democratic socialism. As one of the great leaders in American history, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, and I quote, "Call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but there must be a better distribution of wealth within this country for all of God's children," end quote.
And I'm adding the applause in here because it deserves more than you hear on the tape. Again, we're listening to a bit of Bernie Sanders from his brilliant speech delivered Wednesday, something that the networks should have carried live but virtually ignored because it was of great importance. I really think everybody needed to hear that. And Harvey J.K. is with us. Yeah,
we could do your full show just on this speech.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you.
Absolutely.
The whole afternoon.
Well, you know, I actually thought about it. I thought about taking a show one day and just replaying the speech because, you know, like with the Mueller report, I think the majority of people didn't sit down and listen to it. I want to do everything I can to put it out there because it deserves to be heard.
Yeah, and it really does stay absolutely true to the spirit of FDR's 20th century economic Bill of Rights. What it does, however, is it takes it one step further. As I looked through his short list that he presented, I know how he took each of FDR's lines and turned it into a short, crisp statement. Mm-hmm. But the one thing he added, which is so crucial and really is for him to lay claim to this whole idea of a Green New Deal, is the right to a clean environment. And that takes us into that 21st century direction. But, you know, it's interesting, too, as much as FDR will be known for trying to revive the industrial economy and for massive public works projects, we shouldn't forget, and in this sense, he's really also staying true to the spirit of FDR, that FDR's New Deal decidedly included addressing the environment.
Did it?
Yeah, the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, in particular, went out and planted millions and millions of trees. Okay, mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, the Dust Bowl of the Plain States that devastated not only their economies but also sent in piles of dust over the country to the east. That also required addressing the environment, and they set up these extensive we'll call them wooded areas in order to reduce the wind's effects on the Great Plains, and they also did a whole series of other things really to try to address the environment. I mean, there was central to so much of what FDR was about is still the kinds of things we need to do today, which is why Bernie could say that this is the unfilled promise or it's the unfilled job of the Democratic Party. I mean, he doesn't want to accuse all of his fellow Democrats, but I'll speak on his behalf, uh-huh. I think. Mm-hmm. The Democrats, for the last 45 years, maybe even longer, but especially the last 45 years, really did turn their back on the FDR tradition. They turned their back on working people, and they emphasized a whole other array, you know, of a sort of liberal, educated elite in the Democratic Party, instead of holding on to labor, empowering labor, or especially in the 70s, the 80s to today, defending labor against the assault of big business and the Republican right. So, I mean, Bernie spoke the truth. He didn't necessarily always point the fingers where they might well have gone, but I think the Democrats who might have listened knew who he was talking about when he said the folks inside of the party might have reservations about what he wants to
do. Oh, yeah. Well, FDR, and the perfect example, it's just look at Nancy Pelosi. Years, she actually was considered progressive. I don't know if it's just age catching up with her that's warped her thinking, or the money that she's amassed all these years. I know she comes from a wealthy family anyway, and her husband has a lot of money too, but she's enriched herself during all these years she spent in the House in leadership in ways that she probably shouldn't. I went apoplectic earlier this week when I saw her speaking at the Pete Peterson Financial Summit.
Oh my goodness, I'm so glad you called my attention.
And talking about how she loved Pete Peterson, and he was a national hero. Pete Peterson was the guy who came up with the scam to cut Social Security and Medicare to, quote, fix the debt. That's where...
Yeah, I do believe... Oh, right? Isn't he the guy, basically, who pushed Obama to create the...
The grand bargain. What was it called? The grand bargain, right?
The grand bargain.
Yep.
And that budget commission,
that's
basically.
Right.
He made sure that Obama stayed inside the ranks of neoliberalism.
Exactly. And for Nancy Pelosi to proclaim, I love Pete Peterson, he's a national hero. We got to get that debt under control. Excuse me. How about calling Stephanie Kelton to Capitol Hill to testify about modern monetary theory and screw your debt?
That's
a subject for another day. But and more recently, Nancy Pelosi's stance on impeachment. Harvey J.K., you're a professor of democracy and freedom. Donald Trump this week said he would welcome foreign governments, even adversaries, dirt on a political opponent in the next presidential election. And she doesn't think that's grounds for impeachment?
Yeah, well, and that's like the cherry on top to the whole Trump experience. Now, here's what I don't get. Look, one can fully appreciate Pelosi's fear of the fact that Republicans may not be willing to remove the Senate Republicans might not be willing to remove him from office.
Right.
But here's the thing to remember. The fact is that Clinton was impeached, was not convicted in the Senate.
Right.
And then the Democrats lost the presidency anyhow.
Right.
So what is this
so
stuff?
It worked out for the Republicans. And for them to spin this as, oh, it really hurt, you know, it hurt the Republicans to bring impeachment. No, it didn't.
No,
they
it didn't.
Won the
Absolutely
next presidential
not.
Election. And they would, you know, it didn't hurt them big in Congress. It didn't. And this should not even be a consideration. The fact that this president is poo-pooing at the Hatch Act, which today he said he doesn't abide by, he will not fire Kellyanne Conway. The Hatch Act will never be adhered to again. The fact that he's telling his both current White House staffers and former employees to ignore congressional subpoenas, he's just thumbing his nose at the rule of law. He's saying it does not apply to me. And I don't know how we come back from something like that.
Yeah, I don't either. And which makes this... You know, there's one thing I would love our listeners, especially if they didn't have a chance to hear the speech itself, to hear. Did you happen, I don't know, this is one I didn't actually request. Do you happen to have a tape, a recording of when Bernie starts asking the question, are you free?
No. I'll just read a few
if that's okay.
Yeah, go.
It's just an amazing, what he does is, he says, what I believe is that the American people deserve freedom, true freedom. Freedom is an often used word, but it's time we took a hard look at what that word actually means. Ask yourself, what does it actually mean to be free? And then he lays out these questions where he brings this seemingly academic question of freedom right down to earth. And he says, are you truly free if you're unable to go to a doctor when you are sick or face financial bankruptcy when you leave the hospital? Are you truly free if you cannot afford the prescription drug you need to stay alive? And he goes on and on. Here's another one. Are you truly free if you're a small business owner or family farmer who's driven out by the monopolistic practices of big business? Are you truly free if you're a veteran who put your life on the line to defend the country and now sleep out on the streets? And he does about a dozen of these. And if that didn't bring home the meaning of true freedom, and it took us back to FDR, who in the speech in 1944 said, necessitous men are not free men, meaning needy men are not free men, or needy people are not free people.
Wow.
It was just a remarkable, over and over again in the speech, Bernie impressed me, one, by the way in which he really did reach back, sort of reclaimed the FDR tradition, and then, if you like, sort of projected it as something that we today realize has been under siege for all of these decades, and we really do need to redeem it.
Absolutely. Harvey J.K., your students are lucky, I believe.
I would have loved to have had a professor like you.
Follow Harvey on Twitter at Harvey J. K-A-Y-E, and read his books, The Fight for the Four Freedoms and Thomas Paine and the Promise of America.
And hopefully, the Twitter?
And the Twitter, at Harvey J.K. That's what I said, K-A-Y-E.
Oh, sorry, I missed that. But one thing, Nicole, I promise you, this summer, as these things unfold, we'll talk again, I hope.
Great. I look forward to it always.
Okey
Thank
doke.
You so much. Take care,
Thank
Harvey.
You.
Bye-bye. And with that, we're done for the day and the week. Keep the faith, baby. I'll talk to you Tuesday. And for those of you still here, since we didn't get to it during the meat of the show, we'll end with today's What's News. Take it away, Nicole.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Explosions crippled two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman on Thursday in what the United States called attacks by Iran. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that American intelligence agencies had concluded that Tehran was behind the disabling of both ships. Then they released what they say is compelling evidence, video footage of an Islamic Revolutionary Guard patrol boat pulling up alongside the Kakuka Courageous, one of the stricken ships, a few hours after the initial explosion, and removing what American analysts believe was a limpet mine. Iran responded via Reuters, quote, "We are responsible for ensuring the security of the strait and have rescued the crew of those attack tankers in the shortest possible time." Foreign Ministry spokesman Abbas Mousavi is quoted as saying, "Obviously, accusing Iran for such a suspicious and unfortunate incident is the simplest and most convenient way for Mike Pompeo and other U.S. officials. These accusations are alarming." Meanwhile, the owner of the tanker shown in that video, Yukaka Katata, speaking at a press conference in Tokyo on Friday, contradicted Mike Pompeo and the U.S. Navy when he said his ship was attacked on the starboard side by a flying object, not by a mine. Quote, "It seems that something flew towards them that created the hole," is the report I've received. "It seems there was a high chance they were attacked by a flying object. The impact was well above the water. I don't think it was a torpedo." The Japanese ship owner did not say who might be responsible for the attack. I say, beware of an administration looking to change the news narrative, and I'll remind you of a tweet Donald Trump sent back in 2011 that warned, quote, "In order to get elected, Barack Obama will start a war with Iran." Just saying.
I'm glad to go. I cannot tell a lie.
Thursday brought with it the announcement of the imminent departure of White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Thursday also marked the 94th day since Sanders last appeared behind the podium in the White House press briefing room. Meanwhile, the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, no relation to Robert Mueller, says that White House advisor Kellyanne Conway should not work for the government anymore because she violated the Hatch Act by using her platform to attack Democrats running for office and advocating for Republicans during TV appearances. The Hatch Act is a 1939 law that bars federal employees from engaging in partisan politics while serving in their official roles. The White House, of course, pushed back, saying Conway's actions aren't violations, and the final decision on her job rests with the president anyway, who is unlikely to remove her. The reverberations of Donald Trump's interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos continue. Democrats attempted to pass a bill in the Senate Thursday, making it illegal for campaigns not to report offers of foreign assistance to the FBI using unanimous consent. But Marsha Blackburn objected.
These reporting requirements are overbroad. Any person who shares their views with a candidate would be reportable. Campaigns could have to report social media responses or interactions. You would report every non-U.S. citizen or dreamer who volunteers for their campaign or knocks on doors, or even knocks on the door of a foreign national.
Senate Intelligence Committee ranking Democrat Mark Warner is the one who introduced the legislation, and he pushed back on Blackburn's false claims.
I would point out that her reading of my legislation is not accurate. The only thing that would have to be reported is if an agent of a foreign government or a foreign national offered something that was already prohibited. And candidly, and I will take my colleague at her word, if there are ways to improve on this legislation, I'm wide open for business.
And the chairwoman of the Federal Election Commission, Ellen Weintraub, weighed in. She released a statement Thursday making clear that candidates for public office may not receive help from a foreign government in what appeared to be a warning to the president. Tweeting her statement, Weintraub wrote, "I would not have thought that I needed to say this. Let me make something 100% clear to the American public and anyone running for public office. It is illegal for any person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national in connection with a U.S. election. This is not a novel concept," end quote. Well, we've all heard the stories about Donald Trump not paying his bills. I guess that applies to his presidential campaigns, too. Last week, officials in El Paso, Texas, complained that they were still waiting for Trump's reelection campaign to pay up for expenses related to a rally months ago. It turns out 9 more cities haven't received a dime for similar charges. Prosecutors in Michigan dropped all criminal charges related to the ongoing water crisis in Flint on Thursday, more than 3 years into the investigation, saying that they would start from scratch and wage a, quote, vigorous pursuit of justice. Stay tuned. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.